From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, a Milwaukee organization that's trying to break the cycle of blackmail, incarceration, and unemployment.
There is a real fear and, frankly, a risk by hiring someone from background challenges. We look at it as more of, hey, there are times we understand there's issues. We're going to set aside some time to help them overcome them.
Then internationally known chef Maria Liberati returns to Milwaukee and Festa Italiana with a new cookbook. Michigan writer Andy Mozzino looks back at the Milwaukee area of his childhood as a setting in his new short stories.
People in Milwaukee, you know, they would chop down trees and pour metal into molds and build farm equipment, and then winter would come and they would drink. And that's us.
And we hear the first audio postcard from the Listening to Mitchell Public Art Project. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It is so nice to have you listening today. This summer, we've been listening back to some of the highlights from our recent Project Milwaukee series on the causes and impacts of Wisconsin's high rate of incarceration among African American men. Today, we'll revisit a story about a Milwaukee organization that's trying to break the cycle of incarceration and unemployment. At the same time so many African American men have served time in prison, the number of jobs in the inner city has dwindled. And while some state-sponsored programs allow inmates to leave prison with skills, there's no guarantee of employment, and often a prison record is an insurmountable obstacle, leaving ex-offenders with few legal options to support themselves or their families. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke visited a facility that serves a small but growing number of ex-offenders who are challenged to find meaningful employment.
The building looks like any one of a thousand old industrial plants on Milwaukee's north side, places that were once bustling with activity as the city thrived in the 1940s and 50s, but has been in decline ever since. But the sense of idleness outside the red brick structure belies the scene inside. That's where you'll find Leroy Macklin at work on a computer.
We sell CDs, DVDs, VHSs, books, games, video games, different variety of things, tools. Also, just got into tools. Things to help us, like I said, keep our top-selling rank up.
That's a top-selling ranking on Amazon. Macklin is one of the longest-tenured employees of Milwaukee Working, an organization that helps former inmates and some others develop a solid work history. Milwaukee Working is in a number of industries. Selling donated merchandise is a fast-growing part of its portfolio.
When a product come in, either it's a DVD, CD, I clean it, refurbish it, make it brand new. But when I list it on Amazon, I describe it to the best of my knowledge. But even though the CD might come out brand new or anything, I still say that it still got scuffles on it. I under-describe it. So once they get it, they see, oh, it's practically like new.
Macklin says that customer satisfaction is behind the top seller rating they've earned. It's a far cry from where he might have expected himself to be at this point. Much of his early life was spent amid drugs and violence on Milwaukee streets, but he says two things set him on a different path: 10 months in jail and the responsibilities of parenthood.
My oldest son, who's 8, going on 9 now, he kept looking at me. I'm looking like, Daddy, we're going to the block. I got tired of hearing that. And me calling myself a grown man, I decided I got really procure and, you know, stand out for my son. So now that I'm here, faithfully come to work every day. I try not to miss no days, but been here faithfully every day. My kids really like that. They like coming here working with me.
Macklin was one of the original 4 employees hired by Milwaukee Working when it opened as an offshoot of the nonprofit Community Warehouse in 2010. Nearly 20 people work jobs there now. CEO Bob Wolf says the goal is not to develop lifelong employees. Rather, it's to give people work experience that will make them more attractive to private industry.
You know, there is a real fear and, frankly, a risk that private sector companies have to take by hiring someone from background challenges. For us, we look at it as more of, hey, there are times we understand there's issues. We're going to set aside some time to help them overcome them. If we don't, they may never overcome them.
For many former inmates, the issues are more than just learning a marketable skill to bring to a new employer. They're learning about life skills that enable them to navigate everything from the medical system to finding their next job. That's why the converted dairy plant not only has production space, but also a brightly lit common area with comfortable chairs, tables, and computer stations.
What's great is if they need to talk about something, they can come up the stairs, come in the resource center for a half an hour, and then go right back to work. And it really makes it, otherwise they'd have to go off-site, right? Who knows how long it would take? They'd have to track it down. There's transportation issues, many other things that come into play that would take their time away from work.
In addition to the online Amazon marketplace, Milwaukee Working operates a wood shop and cabinet making facility and an electronics disassembly and recycling center. Employees learn skills from driving a forklift to using a nail gun to working with specialized saws to build doors, vanities, and kitchen cabinets. Bob Gunn manages the wood shop and says he couldn't be more pleased with his employees.
They're so eager, they want to learn as much as they possibly can. And they're here on time. They make a 100% effort on what they're doing. They're extremely respectful. They give you basically everything that they possibly can. Their heart is in it, and that's the whole thing.
But sometimes they do mess up. Bob Wolf says they've had issues with reliability, though employees are not fired for occasional slip-ups. He says the long-time employees play an important role in setting new hires on the right path, and Leroy Macklin agrees.
Guys know I've been through what they've been through or what they're going through, so I try to be help. Actually, guys ask me to be their mentor. I try to, you know, even motivate them, you know, to do the right thing. So, like, if I have trouble, I have questions or I need somebody to talk to, I can go to people that been here longer than me. Like I said, the guys, wonderful team leads. Just like the guys look at me and they come to me, talk to me about anything.
They also come to Chris Lesko. The Brookfield woman is one of the volunteers in the resource center, sometimes helping write resumes, sometimes just listening and talking employees through their problems. She says she isn't bothered by the criminal records of the people she works with.
No, that hasn't really affected my decision to come here at all. In fact, if anything, it makes me want to understand more, you know, what's going on in their lives. And just the joy of seeing them turn their lives around is huge. And it really just motivates you to want to help more people be able to turn their lives around.
The building itself is still a work in progress. Milwaukee Working strives to operate under a self-sustaining business model. But it's also helped through the support of funders such as the Helen Bader Foundation. Program officer Jerry Roberts sees a metaphor in the transformation of the once dilapidated factory.
It takes an abandoned building. You take some folks who, in essence, have been abandoned by the system, by society, and kind of dismissed, like this building had been, and it transforms that.
For his part, Leroy Macklin shudders to think what his life might look like without his job.
If I didn't have this, I'd be steady in the street. Thank God I'm still here, I'm still living. Unfortunately, Mike would have been dead or in jail.
And for Macklin, that's as good as a top seller rating on Amazon. For Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Teich in Milwaukee.
You'll find more from our Project Milwaukee series at wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. Just in time for Festa Italiana, Chef Maria Liberati returns to Milwaukee with a new cookbook and some history about one of Italy's most famous sons. We'll be back with the basic art of Italian cooking, Da Vinci style, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We are in full festival swing in Milwaukee. This weekend is the annual celebration of all things Italian, also known as Festa Italiana. And in between bocce games, gondola rides, and fast Ferraris, you can also find special guests like internationally renowned chef Maria Liberati. Liberati is an award-winning author and blogger of the Basic Art of Italian Cooking series, and the newest one is called Da Vinci Style. Yeah, that Da Vinci. It turns out, in addition to painting and inventing, Da Vinci was also quite the gourmet. Liberati's book focuses on the history and food of the regions that Da Vinci lived in. It's both a history and a cookbook. Ahead of her appearances in Milwaukee this weekend, Liberati joins me in the studio now to talk about the inspiration for her book. Maria, welcome to Lake Effect. It is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it's so nice to be here also, and I always enjoy and look forward to my time in coming to Milwaukee every year for Festa.
How many times? How long has it been?
Let's see. This is the third year. So I was here last year for Festa last year, and then 2 years ago for my first Festa. So,
and what makes it different for you?
What makes each year different?
Coming here to Festa, is it different from other festivals?
Oh, yes, it is. It's gigantic. I think people are really crazy about their Festa here. You know, in other cities in the country that I've done these types of Festas, they're kind of big, but this seems to be like the biggest one I've been to in the U.S. And people are they really go crazy with this Festa, crazy in a good way. So I find a lot of heart in the city, you know, in this whole Festa thing. And I just really enjoy it. I really look forward to it.
Well, we're so glad to have you back.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And this time you have a new book,
yes.
A new cookbook, The Basic Art of Italian Cooking. But the twist on this one is it's Da Vinci style. And what you did is take the life of Leonardo da Vinci and translate it and interpret it in food.
Yes.
And I wanted to know where that came from. What a great idea, first of all. But what made you think of doing the book this way?
Well, it came from my love of Leonardo da Vinci. And when I'm in Italy, because I live both in Italy and the U.S., we have a farm in Abruzzo. So I go back and forth. And luckily, you know, being in Italy, you can get more intensely involved in studying about him. There's so much more there. And I found out that Leonardo da Vinci was truly a foodie. And that was another dimension among all the other things that he was, you know, philosopher and writer and scientist and architect and politician
artist
and artist. Exactly. I forgot about that one. That was the most important. But anyway, he was a foodie, and he had his beginnings in food because his mother, his real mother, who couldn't marry his father because they had him out of wedlock and she was a lower kind of a class system than he was, her family had a bakery. And even though his real father married someone else, the real father used to let him go and spend time at his real mother's bakery with his real grandfather. And he started doing sculptures out of marzipan. That was his first artistic sort of tendencies. And then his father saw all of this artistic stuff coming out in him, you know, his artistic talent. And his father enrolled him in a school in Florence, Andrea Verrocchio's workshop, who was famous for teaching all these very famous artists. Anyway, Da Vinci ended up putting together a restaurant with Botticelli. Sandro Botticelli was studying with Da Vinci at Verrocchio's workshop, and they needed a way to make ends meet and support themselves when they became late in their later teens. So first of all, Da Vinci worked as a waiter in a restaurant. And he started getting more and more into it because one night all the chefs died because of food poisoning, and they turned over the head chef position to Leonardo da Vinci. And it worked for a little while, but it didn't go over well because he had these forward ideas of how food should be served. He wanted to do the nouveau cuisine, small portions, very fancy, and people just weren't used to that. So clients started little by little leaving this restaurant, and they ended up firing him. So he got the idea for him and Botticelli to open their own restaurant.
Now, there you go. Botticelli and Da Vinci opening
imagine?
A restaurant.
Can you imagine?
I can't even – it's like it's so funny.
Yes. Yes, and right on Ponte Vecchio, which is – it was right there. Again, it didn't last too long because they had all these artistic ideas. You know, they drew out a menu, and you can actually find one of the menus. It's floating around online. It's very artistic, so people couldn't really understand what they were talking about and all. And they had the same idea of serving small portions, very nouveau sort of cuisine thing, which didn't go over big because back then people were used to just eating these lump portions of everything.
If they were going out at all.
Yes, if they were going out at all. Exactly. So they would, you know what, they would be mostly people that were traveling for work. So it's not like people, you know, just went out on a weekend to eat. So they were not people that were really into the nouveau cuisine and things. So anyway, obviously that restaurant did not last long and it closed, but he ended up inventing a lot of things or the beginnings of a lot of the utensils that we use in the kitchen. And he then went on to be commissioned by other like members of the royal family to make different things. And he ended up with the King of France, who eventually made him in charge of his kitchen as well as an architect for projects. And he actually designed his kitchen and he designed some really very interesting aspects of the kitchen. So without going on and on and on, you know, these are all the things that I started to find out. And in fact, there were just so many facts and I had to get the book ready. So a lot of all these other facts that are on the side, I didn't even put in that book. I'm intending to put in a revised version because there was just so much stuff. It was just so fascinating. I would just get so wrapped up in it that it's like, okay, I have to pull myself away now. You're doing a book and you got to get it done by a certain time.
Well, and you're doing a cookbook.
Yes.
And you have to actually get the recipes in. But what I loved about it is the way you juxtapose the bits of history.
Yes.
With the recipes that represented either the time that where he was or the place where he was. How was it for you as the cookbook side of you now, not the historian side of you, the cookbook writer, to choose those recipes? I mean, it must have been difficult to pick.
Yes, it was difficult. And I always – my own philosophy has always been that food is more than just a recipe. There's so much more, especially Italian cooking, attached to food. So one of the reasons I chose to do that to coordinate the stories of where he went to with the food is because I've never felt that you can just have recipes in a book. Food, there's so much more meaning to it, and I think you need to bring that out. So all of my books have stories like that bring out something more about the dish. But as far as your question about picking out the recipes, yes, it was very difficult to kind of pick and choose which ones. I just tried to choose the ones that I felt were more representative of those regions, because you're right, the recipes from the specific regions that he stopped at. It's found that most of the regions that he stopped at were places, if he spent a long time there, it's because he liked the food. So he didn't like Bologna that much because they have very heavy cuisine. And historians have said that he was a vegetarian. So he wasn't really too fond of Bologna because Bologna has – their cuisine is really heavy on meat. But anyway, so it was difficult picking the recipes, but I tried to pick ones that were really – that kind of told a story, more of the history of that place, because I think that it makes the recipes more interesting when you know you're creating something. It's already been created, but you're making something that has so much more to it than just, you know, a bunch of ingredients you're throwing together and that's it.
Well, there's a context to it. There's some sort of historical background, something that you can say, well, you know, they made it this way in 1500.
Exactly.
One of the things you talk about is the use of stale bread and the fact that Italians don't throw away food. Mm-hmm. If they can avoid it, they're going to find a way to use it, even if it's quote unquote spoiled, because it probably isn't spoiled.
Right.
It just needs to be used in a different way. Mm-hmm. And the use of the bread, I didn't know about using the bread to thicken a sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a number of recipes that take the stale bread and you cook it down into a sauce and it makes a soup or it makes...
Yes. And you know, those recipes are from what was known as the cucina povera, which means the peasant kitchen. When the Italians, I mean, they were basically walking around barefooted, didn't have enough money for shoes. So they had to do what you just said. They had to keep those ingredients and just reuse them as much as they can. Their bread is made from really high quality ingredients. So it generally doesn't spoil. spoil as quickly as, say, a loaf of regular American bread. So you can hold it and use it and reuse it. And it was very innovative. The things they were thinking of, you know, to do, like you said, thicken the sauce with the bread, and they do all kinds of cakes and salads reusing this bread. However, one of the funniest things is that a lot of the most expensive restaurants now use these recipes from what they used to consider a peasant kitchen. You know, the Papa al Pomodoro, which is just what you're talking about, where it's a tomato soup that it comes from Tuscany and it's thickened with the bread. I just went to an expensive restaurant in New York City for a dinner for the consortium of the Chianti makers. And one of the recipes was, and that's a normal thing, Papa al Pomodoro that they serve there. It was actually quite good. It said that back in history, the Florentine women from Florence, the Tuscan women, they love their husbands so much, so they wanted to, you know, they put passion into what they were cooking for them and heart. And that's how they really put their mind to, how am I going to make these wonderful dishes for my husband with using, you know, we don't have the money for these fancy ingredients. And they spent a lot of time on thinking these things that, you know, that seem like, you know, they're kind of almost simple, stupid things. You know, like, who would have thought of that? It's just so simple. But you would have to spend time, because you're right. You wouldn't – who would have thought that bread would thicken, you know, would thicken
and
a soup?
And cook down that – basically that you wouldn't taste the bread. It would just
right.
become a thickening
you would
agent.
Think, yeah. Right. You would think it would be the soppy bread. But, you know, it's unbelievable. But, yes, they spent loads of time on what they did. Da Vinci did the same thing. He would sit for hours until he just got it correct, whatever he was doing. You know, kind of reminds me of that, the women that – invented this peasant kitchen. There are all these recipes, just as we're talking about using the bread for that. And they do cakes like that, too. It's just unbelievable. You know, they come up with cakes where they're using the day-old bread, or the bread that might be a week old, really. So it's just unbelievable the things that, you know, that they invented to do with that, that they're still doing now.
Well, the idea of, you know, farm to table and all of that is so popular now. But of course, they were doing that then in Italy and France, and because they had the fresh, I mean, if you didn't grow it, you probably didn't have it.
Yes, yes.
And so freshness, of course, plays a big role in this cookbook as well.
Yes.
Fresh ingredients, as fresh as you can possibly get.
Yes. Yes, that plays a role in all of my cookbooks, because I think that's also a key of real Italian, authentic Italian cooking. It's not that I think it is. It's the key to real Italian cooking is using the freshest and the best ingredients. And if you do, you don't need a lot of, say, Parmesan cheese, if you use that, you're not using the real Parmigiano Reggiano. If you use Parmigiano Reggiano, you should only use a little bit, because you're getting the real flavor of it. If you use a substitute, then you do have to use a lot. So the idea is just small quantities, and you let the flavors work together and balance each other. And that's the, you know, the true sort of formula for the real authentic Italian cooking, is balancing flavors, using the freshest and the best ingredients as well. So
when you talk to, like you're going to do here at Festa, you talk to people who are interested in cooking, they're home cooks.
Yes.
Maybe there's somebody who has never really dared to read a recipe like this and try to do something. How do you teach them? What do you tell them to do so that they're not afraid to go into the kitchen and try?
You know what? When I first did my very first book, what I did was I first tried out the recipes, because I was doing a lot of cooking programs in Italy, because I spoke both Italian and English. So I was getting asked to do those when I first started out. What I did was I tested the recipes out on, you know, I wanted to make sure they could follow them. The one thing, though, about Italian cooking, it's not like French cooking. It's not complicated. It's really very simple. You know, I just tell them to try it. And also, you know, don't be so worried about getting the most perfect results and following everything exactly. Because really, Italian cooking also, you have to put a little of yourself in the recipe, because you have to kind of feel, you actually feel the ingredients. But it, you know, it takes a while to be able to do that. So, you know, I always tell people to have fun with it, because that's the most important thing. And just try the most simplest recipe, you know, learn how to cook pasta, because there are people that are afraid to cook pasta. And usually people will, once they kind of get over that hump of like, oh, yeah, I can do this, then they'll usually go on to kind of trying the next. But Italian cooking is not as complicated as people think it is.
So basically, don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. That's it. Don't be afraid. And you might even want to put a little bit of, when I say a little bit of yourself into it, you know, if you think you want to put more salt or more oregano or something, you know, do that, because it's your recipe. Those are my recipes, but you might want to flavor to what you like. So, you know, have fun with it. Also, you can try and add something else or take something away depending on your taste, but definitely don't be afraid. And just the main thing is to start, you know, try the recipe. I've had one recipe, I'll tell you, linguine alla vongole, linguine with clams. I remember when I tried, because I think that's in my first book, when I tried it in a cooking program that I did, people were so afraid when I said we're going to do this linguine alla vongole. And it was like, people were, they were like so surprised. Wow, I did, you know, linguine with clams. And it's because it's just linguine pasta, clams, olive oil, garlic, a little bit of salt, a little bit of pepper, parsley. And that's basically linguine with clams. It's just that you have to, you know the time frame and all that and when to put whatever you need. You know, so it's really not complicated if you're not afraid to do it. You know, it's really very easy.
It was the clams that scared people. They don't know how to open them up.
Exactly. But it's really very simple also. Yes, yes.
So do you have a favorite recipe that you're going to be sharing with us here in Milwaukee this weekend?
Well, I have a lot of favorite ones, as you probably can figure out. But one of my favorite ones is I have this risotto that I do with porcini mushrooms and truffles. So, Parmigiano Reggiano.
Yum.
Yes. Yes. So I think we'll probably use truffle oil, because if you don't have truffles, and you only need like a real quick grating of truffles, because if you've ever had truffles, they're very pungent. So you only need just a teeny little pinch, but it adds so much flavor to it. So that's one of my really favorite recipes, is that risotto. And then there's this torta. It's a cake that comes from Siena. It's called torta senese, which is kind of, to describe it, it's almost like if you took rice pudding and made it as a cake. So, and it's really a traditional dish, which is in the book also, from Siena. So those are my two. And they use rice, because in the north, like when you get further away from the south, they're not that big into pasta as they are, you know, in
that's
the south.
That's where we get the risottos.
Yes, the risotto, yeah. Exactly.
And both of those sound like Da Vinci would have loved them both, because they were vegetarian and simple.
Yes, yes, they are. They're simple and basic, and they use all fresh ingredients. So, and they're not any kind of ingredients other than obviously truffles, but you can get truffle oil now at many gourmet stores.
So
yes.
Well, you have my mouth salivating just thinking about it. I've got the book sitting in front of me. Maria Liberati, it has been such a pleasure to meet you, and welcome back to Milwaukee.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here again.
Maria Liberati is an award-winning author and expert on Italian cuisine and culture. Her most recent cookbook is The Basic Art of Italian Cooking, Da Vinci Style. Liberati is in Milwaukee this weekend at Festa Italiana. There is a link to her schedule from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll speak with the author of a new short story collection, Quality Snacks, ahead of his appearance at Boswell Books tonight. You are listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today. Brookfield native Andy Mozina's second collection of short stories has just been published. In Quality Snacks, Mozina, who's a professor of English at Kalamazoo College in Michigan, finds many of his characters inhabiting the Milwaukee area of his own childhood. 15 stories make up the new collection, which he'll talk about tonight at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Mozina first stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk with Mitch Tyke about the overarching themes he wanted to explore in the new collection.
Well, I think people are trying to live their lives and it generally goes wrong. So one of the themes is disaster, extreme wrongness, bad behavior, good-hearted people not doing what they really wish they could do.
Well, and there are a lot of characters who seem like they are at a precipice of sorts, a potential big turning point in their lives.
Right, yeah, and I think a good short story tries to catch a character in their daily life at an acute moment. And so I'm glad you're sort of feeling that sense of urgency or being on a precipice. So, yeah, you try to catch characters in some sort of crisis, a daily crisis, you could say.
The one that jumps to mind, or I almost should say leaps to mind, is
A Talented Individual.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Thank you. So in A Talented Individual, we have a person who is almost literally on a precipice, but your protagonist is on a much more metaphorical precipice.
Right. There's a circus performer who is at the top of a 110-foot pole, and she's 74 years old, and she earlier in the story has served our main character some ice cream, and he sort of pitied her for being this elderly woman working in an ice cream trailer at a county fair. But then he discovers later that she's actually performing this incredible act on a tall, swaying metal pole. And it freaks him out. And so she is literally taking physical risk, but he is at a point in his life where he can't believe somebody is capable of what she's capable of.
And in the background of this is this career crisis that he been going through.
That's right.
And realizes that all the things that he is unsure of are the things that she must have been sure of to be able to be at that point.
Exactly. She has the confidence and the poise that he realizes he doesn't have. And it's only seeing her perform that he realizes that about himself. And he has always thought of himself as the talented individual. And by the end of the story, he's seeing what that really means through her circus performance, you could say.
Is it that, you know, it strikes me that the twists come fast and furious in a short story, that they lend themselves to pulling the rug out, and there is no way to do that slowly.
Exactly. The shift can, if it's going to catch the reader unaware, it'll have to catch the character unaware as well. And the stories are so compressed, and you do want to get to the action quickly. So that does, hopefully they're not tricks, but they're sort of unexpected developments that are often the most dramatic moment in the story.
Is that what appeals to you about short fiction versus any other form?
I think that short fiction is somewhat easier for me because I only need to know so much about the character and the situation, and the narrative arc only has to be so extensive. In a novel, you really need to know a milieu inside and out. It ought to be a unique milieu. The character movement is huge. You have to know everything in depth. So I've written novels, but I find the short stories are somewhat more congenial for me.
Well, and I wonder, as you approach character development in this shorter form, is it the idea that you really only have to know this person at this point in his or her life?
I think so. It always helps to know backstory. I think with any character, you kind of need to know pretty much their whole life, regardless of what you're going to put on the page. But you don't have to know it in as much depth as in a novel.
Is short story something you teach in your work at Kalamazoo?
Yeah, I teach a course in reading short stories. I teach them in creative writing classes as models for short story writing. Yeah.
Where do things most often go wrong as people learn this skill?
I think that they often don't find the critical dramatic action that will bring about change or prove that no change is possible. So it's coming that they can get into character, they can have an interesting situation, but carrying it forward into some dramatic action that will make a difference, they sometimes have trouble imagining that action.
There are some disturbing things that happen to the characters in the story, many of which we can't really talk about on
That's
the
right.
radio.
Mitch, I'm glad you recognize that they are disturbing. I mean, it shows your psychological health, and I think that's very positive.
Well, and that was what I was going to ask you about, is how do you feel like you have the disturbing thing just underneath the surface and short story helps you tap into it?
I think the disturbing stuff is in some ways an effort to bring humor into the stories. So the disturbing thing is often a tendency or an action that's an exaggeration of some sort of more or less normal impulse, but you want your story to be heightened. I'm interested in situations that are absurd or funny. And so when you turn up a normal instinct to a more extreme level, it does get weird. but it gets more dramatic and it gets more interesting and it puts things in sharper relief. So I just think of it as turning things up a little bit. It's moving a little bit farther out on the continuum of something.
Well, and it's interesting. I don't know whether you will get this comparison. I don't watch a lot of TV, but yeah. the comparison that came to mind as I was reading some of these was Portlandia.
I have not seen that show.
There's just that just extra bit of absurdity, and in the case of Portlandia, it's almost always just humorous absurdity
yeah.
versus disturbingly
yeah.
humorous absurdity. But
yeah, and I like it when. I don't want the humor to be frivolous. I want it to be doing some sort of psychological investigation at the same time. And that's where things do get intense and they get strange a little bit. Hopefully not too strange, but strange enough.
Well, and if it's too strange, you know the story is going to end in 10 pages.
That's right. Yeah, there has to be the option that the character will behave well or sensibly, even if often they don't.
It is not exactly a character in these stories, but Milwaukee makes its presence
yes.
felt.
Yes. So I'd say about a third of the stories either have a Milwaukee setting or there's a couple of Milwaukee expats in Texas. So, yeah, Milwaukee is really important to me. And just in terms of where my imagination goes, I see places in the city and I see things happening there. So I set stories there.
And it is... specifically, really, a Milwaukee of the past and a Milwaukee of your past.
To some extent, yeah. The teenage story I really think of as happening in the 70s on a freeway overpass on I-94 out near West Dallas or Brookfield, the Brookfield border out there. Self-Reliance is a story about sort of the economic decline of Milwaukee in the 70s, sort of the Rust Belt period of Milwaukee's life.
Milwaukee at its own precipice.
Yeah, exactly. The city was kind of in a crisis. And that I kind of came of age when our economy was starting to go downhill. And I noticed that. And I found it to be troubling. And we all know people who have been hurt by the various economic downturns over the decades. And that makes an impression.
At the same time, the Milwaukee you grew up in Brookfield, right? Which
yeah.
is a little removed from much of that.
You know, to some extent, I went to high school at Pius. So, you know, I feel like I lived on the edge of the city, but Milwaukee's not such a big place. It was about 15-minute drive from my house to downtown. So,
how do you think Milwaukee shapes who you are as a writer?
That is a really good question. There must be a good answer to that. I think there's something about a Midwestern sensibility, whatever that means. I mean, people talk about politeness, but that's not really an issue in my stories. I think it's a sensibility. You know, The Onion, I guess, got started out in Madison. You know, David Letterman's from Indiana, which is aspiring to be Milwaukee, I think. It's really trying to be Milwaukee. But so there might be some sense of humor that is Midwestern that I think is informing what I do. And I think that the sensitivity to economic problems, I think, is a Milwaukee. I think of it as a Milwaukee thing.
And I wonder if there's a certain number of – there's a difference in the expectations one has out of life when you come from a place that has experienced a series of downturns
so.
Like this.
I think so. And I think humor is a reaction to various types of disasters and the weather, you know. I mean, people in Milwaukee, you know, they would – chop down trees and pour metal into molds and build farm equipment, and then winter would come and they would drink. And that's just, that's us.
It was really an impressive laundry list of bars and taverns
yes.
that gets mentions throughout this.
Yeah, some of those are real places in West Milwaukee or the Milwaukee area, and some of them are made up.
We mentioned the character that's going through this career crisis.
Yeah.
You yourself have, if I remember correctly, a degree in economics.
Yes.
You went to law school for a short time.
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about the change that your life plan went through?
I'm really glad I ended up teaching English, and I'm really glad I got into writing. You do think about alternative paths. I think it's really hard to figure out your identity and to figure out what you need to be doing in life. And I think everybody, especially in midlife, has this various moments of reevaluating. Did I do the right thing? Am I on the right path? Is this going well? And a lot of it's not even up to you. You know, sometimes your job will just give you a smack or you'll lose your job or something will happen, then you'll be forced to rethink it.
Do you have other fiction in the works?
I do. I have a novel about a harpist, divorced harpist in Chicago who is taking a symphony audition. And it's the couple of months leading up to the audition, so he's preparing. He's in a new relationship. He's got a young daughter who is emotionally troubled. And his father dies early in the novel, and he ends up playing harp at a hospice, a residential hospice. So he has all these stresses on him as he's trying to audition for this. And it's kind of his life goal to make it into an orchestra. And he's come close, but he's hoping that this audition will be the one that puts him over the top.
And if nothing else, I don't think the divorced harpist genre is oversaturated at this point.
No, there are very few. Yeah, there are very few harpists to begin with. He happens to be a straight harpist. Most harpists are gay or lesbian. And so he feels a little bit misplaced in certain ways. And he's trying to audition for a new role in life as well as get this audition, get the chair in the orchestra.
Well, it sounds completely intriguing. And I hope you'll come back and see us when that one is under your belt.
I hope that gets published. And then I will come back and talk again, I guess.
Well, Andy Mozina, first of all, congratulations on this book. Best of luck moving forward, and I hope we'll see you again soon.
Thank you so much, Mitch. It's been real fun to talk to you.
Andy Mozina is the author of the short story collection Quality Snacks, published by Wayne State University Press. Mozina grew up in Brookfield, and he now teaches English at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. His previous book was called The Women We're Leaving the Men. He spoke with Mitch Tyke, and he'll talk more about his new collection this evening at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. We'll take one last break and then return with an essay from contributor Liam Callanan, and then the first audio postcard from the Listening to Mitchell Public Art Project. So stay tuned. Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, right after this. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Summer's a great time for a road trip. Lake Effect essayist Liam Callanan decided to be thematic in his summer travels this year.
Earlier this summer, I went on one of the world's great outdoor theater odysseys, a 5,500-mile trek across the globe that not only skipped New York and London, but also, for that matter, any city with a population of more than 40,000. In fact, the population at our first stop was roughly 10, unless you include my daughter and me, in which case it was 12. And the audience at our last stop was around 100, but it was in a darkened lower level of a parking garage, so it was hard to tell. I should back up. Survey your friends' top summer destinations, and you'll find a pattern emerges. The beach, any beach. A baseball game, fresh air, anywhere. Ask me, and you'll hear one word. A theater. Any theater, as long as it is outdoors. I know some people, members of my own family, think differently. Watching a performance outdoors means sweating under sunlight or swatting at bugs at night or worrying that the skies are about to pour. But for me, part of the drama in drama is the drama of watching it. Indoors, in the dark, the rest of the world too easily falls away. Outdoors, I really have to focus, and the actors really have to focus me to make the story come alive. And so they did this summer. In late May, my 11-year-old daughter and I had the extraordinary opportunity to visit one of the oldest and greatest theaters in the world, the Ancient Theater of Epidaurus. Located about 2 hours west of Athens in Peloponnesian Greece, Epidaurus saw its first stage productions nearly 2,400 years ago and is still putting them on today. My daughter and I weren't able to time our visit to see the theater in use, so on a lonely, sunny afternoon, we put it to use ourselves. The acoustics of this outdoor theater are famous. Its exacting geometry means even a whisper at center stage can reach every last one of its 14,000 limestone seats. My daughter tried it. I tried it. The handful of other tourists tried it. And we were all held spellbound, not just by the sound of each other's voices, but by the fact that voices have been echoing on this hillside for almost 2.5 millennia. Is it a stretch to say I felt something similar in a parking garage 10 days later in downtown Mankato, Minnesota? Not really. Another daughter, my oldest, and I were there for a festival that turned out to be even more clever and fun than its title, Shakespeare in the Parking Garage. 4 short plays, all original riffs on Shakespeare, performed in the great outdoors atop a parking garage with all downtown Mankato as a backdrop. Or that was the plan. A thunderstorm arrived and the production quickly moved downstairs so that actors and audience could have a roof over their heads. I had a play in the mix, but what was more thrilling was to be part of that evening's theater community that seemed as ancient as it was instant. Seated on blankets and lawn chairs and benches, ours was claimed between acts, it turned out it was a prop, people had come out at the start of summer to watch other people cast a spell. A simple spell. Words and gestures, some costumes, props. Not unlike what you might find at any outdoor theater, even Epidaurus. I mentioned to some people how sitting in that parking garage felt very much like sitting in those acoustically perfect stone benches in Greece, and they were shocked. But I swear, as the audience quieted in anticipation of the next play's first words, you could hear from as far away as the furthest parking space, from as far away as Greece, from as far away as the most distant spot on theater history's timeline. Because as the rain fell, the light faded, and the night air swirled, none of it mattered. After more than 2,000 years, the show indeed goes on.
For more on Lake Effect essayist Liam Callanan's adventures with his daughter in Greece, you can read his article in Saturday's Wall Street Journal. You'll find a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect when it's available. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent is named Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Fridays until the end of September. Here's this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street's 7 blocks from the Majeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we are sharing the voices and the sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
And just relax and do it. I don't want to deal with work or nothing to do with work. You know what I mean?
South Side Story.
Oh, well, I was born and raised here on the South Side, and then my grandmother's home. I've lived on and off there since childhood.
My dad loved the people of the neighborhood, the feel of the neighborhood. He liked the texture of the neighborhood. He felt very comfortable being an immigrant neighborhood, no matter where the people were from.
Everything you need is on the South Side. And it used to be back in the day, everything you needed was on Mitchell Street. There were doctors, there's psychiatrists, there's, you know, Walgreens. There's Goldman's. You know, there was really no need to go past Mitchell Street if you needed something.
Mitchell Street was where it was at. This was center city of the South Side of the street.
Well, when I was little, it was Polish. Even right now, I still think of Mitchell, you know, as a Polish South Side.
The economy was not as good in Puerto Rico. There was an earthquake in Mexico City, so 85, 86, 87, many, many young people and families from Puerto Rico and Mexico. Some of us with papers, some of us without papers. We came to Milwaukee.
And then there's people who used to live on the South Side, who moved out to the suburbs, who get that memory back, you know, like, oh, I remember Mitchell Street, you somewhere on Mitchell Street.
We didn't have an entitlement mentality. Everything South gave us, everything Mitchell Street gave us, that was extra. it was better than what we had before. And you learn to appreciate that.
See, I'm so Southside that I stick to like a lot of the things I know, you know? And I've always been open to stuff. And I never even tried corned beef until yesterday.
Like they say, the world is so small, everybody's connected by 9 people, and the South Side is so small, everybody's connected by like 2 people. You know, they know each other intimately. Like they can tell you a whole bunch of stuff about, like, I know their family tree, I know Jorge's mom and dad, and I know his aunt and her kids, and that's a love story of everybody on the South Side.
Dobra. Dobra. Something as good, dobra.
Listening to Mitchell is a public art project by Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr. The project's 18-channel immersive audio installation at 723 West Historic Mitchell Street is open Thursdays and Fridays from 3 to 6:30, as well as Sunday from 2 to 5. To learn more about Listening to Mitchell events and happenings, you'll find a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And don't forget, you can hear the next radio installment in the series next Friday on Lake Effect. And that is all the time we have today. We are produced by Mitch Tyke, Dan Harmon, and Stephanie Lecce, with web assistance from Michelle Maternowski, studio engineering from John Strolecki, and production assistance from Brooke Dowden, Eleanor Peterson, and Audrey Nowakowski. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon for Lake Effect Weekend, which starts at 3, and back here again on Monday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.